This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 15 for Thursday, July 9th, 2009, Battery Park. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outoflinedetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours Greenwich Mean Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line After Hours in the iTunes Music Store.
Welcome to another episode, edition, program of Out of Line After Hours. Great to have everybody who's joining us here tonight. We love the show. We love doing it. And of course, I love doing it with Mr. Peter DeLorenzo, Mr. Auto Extremist. Peter, great having you here every Thursday.
John, good to be here once again. Still alive.
And we're going to work what you wrote in your column on your website, autoextremist.com, this week. Really getting into one of the things GM's got to work on is changing perception.
And, huge.
Huge. And you don't seem to really like what they're doing so far.
Well, they have to basically blow up marketing and advertising and start over. They don't have any excuses or second chances. Now here's their big opportunity. Yeah. To turn over a new green leaf, apparently.
Yeah, well, we'll get into more of that. Okay. Also joining us, David Welch from Business Week. David, great having you here.
Thanks for having me here, John.
And you've been on the show before, but I haven't been on the show with you because when you were on, I was out of town.
That's so right. It's Vines here.
Yeah, Jason.
And I was acting Master Cylinder that day.
The Master Cylinder.
And joining us, the slave.
And joining us too, Anne-Marie Sastry, Professor Anne-Marie Sastry from University of Michigan, who is, I think, the utmost battery expert I'm aware of. Yeah. And you've also got your own company. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we started a company a little over a year ago called SACT3.
SACT3?
That's right.
Oh, what's that mean?
Right on the first try.
Okay.
SACT means power in Sanskrit, a little bit of an homage to my dad, and 3 is for lithium. And mostly it's because we couldn't think of anything better. We had to come up with a name. We had to fill in the paperwork.
So that's cool.
We like it, and it's great fun.
So what's this company going to do, or is it doing?
Hopefully make automotive batteries for electric
vehicles. But you mean
vehicles.
Lithium-ion batteries?
Absolutely.
In Michigan.
Design, engineering, and all that
Correct.
Kind of stuff.
Correct. Near our hopeful customers.
Well, and I want to come back to more of that in a moment. But we also got to talk about who's not here tonight, and that's Jason Vines, because me, Jason, and Peter have been doing the show since the very beginning, and it was great having Jason here, but he got a real job.
He got weird.
Did he ever?
Wait, you mean this doesn't pay?
This doesn't count?
No, I hate to. And look at this picture. We got it up on the screen.
Yeah, that's his official.
Oh, my
Jason.
God.
He looks happy.
Oh, yeah. Well, what a fake photo that is. Look at that. Look at that. I mean, that's that photo, he's been using that. My entire career that I've known him, he's been using that photo.
So and what's the company again?
Zondervan. Carmen brought that up right now. There's the official press release.
Isn't it the largest publisher of Bibles in the world?
Largest publisher of Bibles and I think other Christian books.
In the world.
And it's weird that Jason's the one going to work there.
I would have never. That. I'm glad you said it.
But he told me there's somebody that he knew that
with Nissan,
who's I guess running marketing or something there. And Jason, of course, used to run public relations. Was the VP of public relations for Nissan North America. And he says he's driving down the road one day, and this guy calls him and says, hey, get your ass to Grand Rapids. We need your help. We need to break out of the kind of thinking that we've got ourselves locked into. And Jason will be good at doing that for
you. Yeah. Breaking out of the Grand Rapids mindset and getting into the 21st century, that should be a challenge.
Right.
For Jason. Good, Jason.
But he says he will stop in and join us, and he says once he's got a few things settled, he'll probably Skype in with us, too, every now and then. So we're not going to lose him, but we did have to address the issue
of
why Mr. Vines is not here tonight. But anyway, let's go back to your battery company thing, because I'm just fascinated about this. I mean, batteries seem to be one of the hottest things from a total research and development standpoint in the global industry right now.
I know, it's kind of a joke. We say we don't really want batteries to be too hot of a thing. It's kind of one of the things we work on.
I'm keeping you cool with me.
The U.S., isn't the U.S. like totally lag the rest of the world in this?
So let me start by saying this has happened before. And it'll happen again. Right? We invent something, it offshores, faster, better, cheaper, and then it comes back in a different version or permutation, whatever. So this is totally normal in American history. I mean, we're a technology provider for the world. That's our role. We can get smart people to move here and stay and help us execute our ideas globally. So I'm not so concerned about that, but it is true that we're not center grav right now. And it's absolutely true that that's a real problem.
How did that happen, by the way, that we just kind of sat around while others sped to the
floor. We fiddled, room burned. I don't know. I think
it happens too often in technology.
So David's going to wind me up here because I'm just like, But I've been working in batteries for 14, 15 years. And a lot of the technologies that you see that are now being integrated into vehicles and hybrids and full electric vehicles were American technologies, right? They were based on American patents out of our national laboratories and universities. And there wasn't a lot of interest from American automakers in building vehicles that had substantial percentages of their propulsion, electric. And, Toyota came out with the Prius and got most of the North American hybrid vehicle market. And now we have to play catch up.
And we're trying to play catch up. Where would you rate us right now?
I don't know. I think that's an economist question, maybe, or a strategist question. I, from a technology standpoint, I'd say we're okay. I mean, I walked through the auto show just like everybody else here, and I was very, very happy, very gratified to see that every major car company had some substantial degree of electrification on display. And unlike in previous years, I think it wasn't for show. I know many of the people involved, these are substantive efforts in a time when everybody is crunched financially. So I think this time it's real. Of course, I want to believe that, but I do think that's true.
Well, it gets back to what we've all talked about before is as long as the price of fuel gets real expensive,
yeah.
I have no question, battery cars of any, whether it's plug-in, hybrid, pure EV or whatever it happens to be, can be viable.
Well, they'll be a component of the fleet. They'll never be, it'll be 25% maybe of our fleet will be electrified. But I don't think we'll ever see 50% or
70%. Well, never say never. I mean, because in this business, I learned a long time ago, you never say never.
Well, I just think the ICE still has a long way to go.
Oh, I agree.
In terms of development.
Yeah, but it's got a lot of dollars and years in, unlike batteries and unlike other propulsion technologies that can run electrified drivetrain. I think that right now we're in a very chaotic period, precisely because the ground is shifting beneath our feet in terms of the economics, whether there's going to be some kind of a reasonable tax on gas or whether we're going to sort of put a floor under gas prices or how the cafe is going to work out.
Yeah, we just were talking about that before you got. I mean, going to cafe after all this instead of putting a floor on gasoline was just the dumbest thing this administration.
I've got a couple stories on this. I mean, not only we've been trying CAFE since 1974, and it doesn't get the job done. There are always loopholes in it. The government always says, well, if they start to exploit the loopholes, we'll come in and tighten the screws.
But that's not
But
the loopholes, believe me, are it's meaningless. What's really driven it is that when you keep the fuel price low and all of a sudden you make the car a lot more fuel efficient or even just more fuel efficient, what do you encourage people to do? To drive more.
Absolutely.
Because you've just lowered the cost of driving for them.
They move further away from their place of business. They select activities which require longer. I think there's a bigger issue here, though. And if you look at the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, I mean, what did we really sacrifice? What did ordinary Americans really sacrifice for those huge military deployments? When you get right down to it.
Nothing, really.
This is rant I've been on ever since we invaded Iraq. In World War II, we're rationing gas, canned food,
My mother talks about planting a victory garden.
And what did George Bush tell us when we invaded Iraq? Go shopping.
So as a technologist, I look at this and I say, okay, I mean, maybe it's not even calculus. It's not even algebra. It's just arithmetic. Okay, let's just take a column of numbers of what really goes into the price of a gallon of gasoline and really add up sort of what the infrastructure payments are. And I think if we do that calculation straight up, it doesn't become some, you know, kind of thing in ether figuring out what the gas tax should be. It's come sort of an economic analysis of what we're really paying when we add up the military bases and the Strategic National Oil Reserve and all these things. So, you know, to me as an engineer, I look at this and I say, well, maybe we should just do some arithmetic.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. We're not really paying the full cost of oil. We're not taking into consideration the military aspect of what we need to protect all our dependence on that oil. And we don't look at the environmental or the health impact and price it into that. And if we did, there's been a lot of studies on this, actually, and they're all over the map. It's anywhere from 50 cents a gallon to $2.50 a gallon.
How do you price that? I mean, you basically have to, I think, determine what's the strike point for gasoline prices to get Americans to change their habits.
We found that out a year ago.
Yeah, we did.
$4 a gallon is magic.
Bucks, yeah.
I mean, if
$3.80.
I mean,
$3.50 to $4. Yeah. Take your pick, and then people start to really drastically change their habits. Now, you know, Bill Ford said a long time ago that, you know, he favored a gasoline tax, but he wanted to slowly ramp it up. And I think you sort of have to do that because right now, once you get west of Pittsburgh, you have cities with broad highways, very spread out. I've lived out west. You know, you don't just tell America tell America $4 or $5 a gallon in gasoline. You know, I lived in Dallas, and you know, I commuted about 40 miles, and it took me less than an hour because you got these huge highways.
Right.
And there are people who live all over Denver and Phoenix and L.A. You know, huge cities.
And that was because of cheap.
It'd have to be three to five years.
You have a lot of land. Manifest destiny. Go west, young man. You know, build. And there's a lot of land out in these cities. They're not places like Pittsburgh that are crammed into river valleys, or places like Boston and Washington and New York, where, you know, it's dense population and you know, public transportation works because, you know, you can do a hub and spoke with your subways. It doesn't work out west.
Speaking of dense population, though, I mean, we don't have a lot of megacities in this country. And a couple of the consequences of IC engines in megacities, cancer, asthma, air quality, all of the ills that come with that. And where are the car companies making any money? Well, that would be the emerging economies, right? That would be the economies who are with aspirational middle classes who want to buy vehicles. So even though right now, sitting here in the United States, we bemoan the fact that everything is so, you know, dispersed and we're far apart and we don't know how to add all this up and we don't know how to tax gas. Well, guess what? If we want to address the markets to come, we better figure it out.
Yep.
Better figure it out.
Well, the president can't get up and say, okay, on January 1st, 2010, gas is going to be $5 a gallon. No, but he could say, you know what, on January 1st, 2010, the minimum price you're going to pay for a gallon of gasoline is $2.75 in this country. And then in 2011, it's going to go up another 50 cents. In 2012, another 50 cents. So eventually, we're going to get to the point, folks, that it's going to be $4 a gallon minimum for a price of a gallon of gas in this country. It's going to have to come to that. But since they went with CAFE, we're screwed.
Well, CAFE is just a very slow way of achieving this because it takes 20 years to turn the fleet over in this country. And now, with the economic situation, it's going to take even longer to turn the fleet over.
Yeah.
So even if you pull out the magic wand and wave it today, it's going to take over 20 years before every car in the fleet is there.
Be debating this. To my mind, this is my engineering professor hat on, but we should be talking about what the costs are. We should be having a national discussion about what goes into a gallon of gasoline so that people could be convinced on the facts. I think everybody's so focus grouped to death and so soft lens to death and advertisements and so forth. People believe that you have to sell a message a certain way. I actually don't. I'm an optimist. I think if you put the facts before people, they tend to make pretty logical decisions. And I don't think we're adding it up right now.
Well, we're never going to add up with the way the politicians address things. I mean, they talk around it.
Well, they won't even talk. Very few of them will talk about a gasoline tax. You bring it up, and you get this very pat response. Oh, to taxpayers will never go for it. And it's one of these ridiculous things where the surveys say taxpayers don't want to. Well, yeah. Would you like to pay more for gasoline? No.
Okay, we're right. We're done here.
Yeah, we're done.
Yeah. Okay. Then if you asked them, do you think we ought to maybe
how about
do
take
something?
Your money and give it to me.
No. I think, yeah, though, if you asked them the same thing, do you think that we ought to start putting policies in place that maybe raise the price so people use it less, so we don't import it from countries that might be supporting terrorism?
Or how about the argument?
Raise the question.
How about the arithmetic? How about, here's your total spending. Here's the pie chart of your household income and where it goes, right? Here are two pie charts. Now, here's what happens when we actually have a petroleum-based infrastructure. Oh, look, this is way more expensive than what you think it is, all right? You're paying extra taxes out the wazoo for things like wars and military bases and so forth that maybe you weren't counting up. Now, if we switch to a different infrastructure, I happen to like a grid infrastructure based on electric vehicles. Others would argue for biofuels, whatever it is. Then let's look at the economics. And then it becomes not just a discussion about a gas tax, but about, you know, where is your income going?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. It's all about communications and how you present information to people.
Yeah.
Well, and the other thing is you have to, because the other counter argument that actually has more thought than I don't want to pay more for gasoline is, you know, it does disproportionately hit the poor and the working class because they have to drive. And it just takes a bigger time. So you give them a cut on income tax. I mean, you have to sort of,
bingo,
you know,
mail them a check every quarter, whatever.
You have to communicate how you're going to even it up. And nobody really, there hasn't been an attempt to put together a proposal or even,
well, we don't
for
have
instance.
Our energy policy is.
Well, we haven't had a national energy policy ever.
Well, I heard one oil guy describe it very well. He says, our energy policy is this. We really don't want you to use oil, but we're going to make it as cheap as we possibly can. That's our policy.
We haven't had a national energy policy since what? World War II?
Probably right.
Was there even one then? There was just rationing.
It was reactionary.
Just rationing, right.
It was reactionary, though. I mean, it was a reaction, right, to geopolitics.
Well, Anne-Marie, tell me this. Are we trading dependencies, you know, lithium-ion batteries, or are we now going to become dependent on importing lithium?
Well, I mean, you know, all I can say is my company and bazillions of other companies like mine don't think so.
Why not?
We've looked at the supplies of lithium. Lithium is like the 33rd most abundant element in the Earth's crust. And really, what I think what's going to happen from a technology standpoint is we're going to get better at cracking lithium out of materials. And we're going to ride the cost curve on that.
Come on, you've discovered a big field in Flat Rock.
It's in my backyard. That's why I'm not sweating right now.
All righty.
Out there with a shovel.
Yes, I knew it.
Because I don't think anybody's going to be out in the shovel with a backyard.
Okay.
But there is, you know, plenty of lithium right now for all the lithium-powered cars there are right now. But if things go the way we hope they will, I think we're going to ride the cost curve there. And there are lots of models for this. So there are lots of models for refinements of metals from minerals. And, you know, so I'm not as worried about that.
So what's your view on where the electricity is going to come from if we get this great proliferation of electric cars and how are we, you know, are we gonna
burn coal to do it?
Well, I still think
I still think
electric cars are going to be part of the fleet. It's just not going to be able to take over the whole fleet.
I think the same thing can be said for the grid, right? If you really want zero emission, zero carbon energy generation, it's nuclear, right? Mm-hmm. It's a big part of our portfolio.
So nuclear then? More nuclear plants?
Well, is that my solution? I don't know. It's one solution. It's a zero carbon solution.
The French
nearly do. The French are doing quite well with it.
And they sell their excess.
Of course, this was another case of American technology being refined and really made much more profitable.
We drove it out of this country.
Absolutely, after TMI. So that's one option. I mean, if you look at the percentages in what we generate for wind and solar, I mean, they're minuscule. And people say, well, it's doubled. Well, it's doubled from a really small number. So it's still a very small number. But then there are people, T. Boone Pickens and others, who argue that it could be increased.
He gave up on his wind farm.
He did. I saw that.
Yeah.
It's all about natural
and
gas.
He had an advance order of $2 billion worth of.
Well, he's trying to get rid of 800-something windmills right now. Anybody want to buy a windmill? Call T. Boone. But he now is saying what a bunch of the critics were saying before. Okay, you're going to put all these windmills in the panhandle.
How do you get the
now,
power
how do you
from
get the
them?
Power there without all this degradation all the
degradation,
way down?
And yeah. It turns into a.
And he went,
I think that in the emerging economies, what you'll see is a faster push to diversification of energy technologies. And for that very reason, John, I mean, it's like if you happen to live in a windy area, yeah,
we use wind,
man. If you live in Arizona, solar is good. If you live right next to Niagara Falls, you know what to do.
Hydro is the Canadian.
But see, then you get people don't want the windmills around. Couldn't we just cordon off all of Nebraska? Pack it with windmills? I mean, do we really need people living in Nebraska?
Well, you have the same problem with the panhandle.
You're going to have a lot of angry Nebraskans writing in tonight. Yeah. Well, I mean, his name is Welch,
W-E-L-C-H. If you look at the album cover of Springsteen's album, Nebraska.
That's where I get all my information, actually.
It's exactly where I get mine, too. But that's all I needed to know about Nebraska was this barren, frozen highway, and I thought, my God.
I'm from New Jersey, made an album, called Nebraska.
Have you ever driven across Nebraska?
A lot of angry Nebraskans tonight.
Have you ever driven across?
Well, yes, I have. It takes forever.
It's unbelievable. And the road is absolutely straight. Yeah.
You know,
and it goes on.
Because I haven't seen Nebraska. I've never been there.
Oh, it goes on forever. You got to do it once.
Yeah.
You get to the east edge of the state, and you put your car, and you aim it, and you go for hours.
One of my biggest regrets in my life actually came from driving across Nebraska.
And see what I mean?
We're
very profound.
No, we're driving down the highway by the Platte River, and there's this head of cattle going through the river, and it's real shallow there, and it's a brilliantly sunny day, and you can see horizon to horizon everywhere. And as this cattle's walking through, I'm driving down on the expressway, 70-plus miles an hour, and as they're walking by, I glance over, and it's like the spray coming off their feet going down the stream is like diamonds just shooting out in front of them. With the sunlight and everything, and I went, wow, that's brilliant. And then about 5 miles down the road, I was like, why didn't I stop and take a picture? That was just like, and I...
That was a moment.
It was 20 years later, and I still regret I didn't stop and take a picture of that. It was just one of the most beautiful scenes ever.
Probably one of those things a picture wouldn't have captured anyway, though. Not totally.
You could at least stop and looked at it.
Peter's going to make you feel worse. I'm trying to make you feel better here. But Peter's like, no, you blew it.
So you've been working with GM a lot, right?
Yeah.
Or you're trying to create a whole new generation of battery engineers.
Absolutely.
In this country.
Yeah.
Pick up the
yeah.
story from there.
Well, we don't have enough people to do this. I mean, I think what Peter said is right. It's not, you know, we're going to have a pretty diverse portfolio. And, you know, it's going to be limited by a couple of things. One is technology. We don't have the energy density and the power density in these materials yet to really address a large section of the market quite yet. And people. We don't have enough people to do it. I mean,
people to design and engineer and develop and all that.
People know anything
stuff.
About batteries. People know anything about power electronics. What you were saying about transmission of power, we don't have the people to catch the ball when auto pitches in grid. Right. So not only do you need auto engineers who know how to build the things, you also need people in grid power who know how to connect them, how to load level, how to optimize. Right. And so there's this space between these two huge industries which needs to be filled up. Right. There's a big core of auto that's changing. There's an interface with grid, and there are grid engineers. We started this program a couple of years ago at University of Michigan called Get Energy Systems Engineering. And, you know, there's this old joke. It's like, no matter what happens, some idiot's pet theory is going to be proven correct. that's what I live by, folks. And so, you know, it seemed to those, a few of us working in the technologies, that everything great, you know, that we hope for that comes out of our labs, who are we going to hand it to? I mean, there's nobody to hand this stuff to. There's nobody who can execute, right? And so a few of us got together and spun up a curriculum at University of Michigan, and start to finish the process, I think might have been the fastest on record. It took 4 months between, you know, initial conversations with colleagues, putting it before the faculty for a full vote. It was unanimous, passed. We launched the program September 07. GM has been an extraordinarily strong supporter, signed up 50 of its own engineers who are taking the program online. It's a master's program, so they can continue to work while they're credentialing themselves and learning. And actually, this summer, I'm teaching a battery class online, and we got a bunch of GM engineers taking it, some on-campus students as well.
Just GM, or are others coming in?
Others. Anybody can take it. So anybody can take the class. It's offered online through the University of Michigan. And you know, again, the point is to try to create knowledgeable people who can execute the technology, right? That's actually a rate-limiting step right now.
Wow. It's really cool.
Tell us about...
You don't have to sit through my lectures, so that's why you think that. I'll email you some PowerPoints. You'll go, wow, that's not cool at all. It's really bad.
No, it's cool. I'm glad. I mean, you're dressing issues that people aren't thinking about. It's really crucial. And it goes back to, we were talking about the erosion of the manufacturing base in this country. You know, we need people who understand and can do and contribute. Can't just sit around being this Starbucks nation of zombie consumers.
Where we source technology and we source manufacturing. It's not sustainable.
You can't do it.
Yeah. We come up with financial engineering.
Yeah.
Well, look where it got us.
And we exported it.
Yeah. Kind
of look where it got them.
Yeah, I know.
And then us again. Right? Yeah.
So is the Volt going to work?
Yeah.
The Chevy Volt? You think that thing's going to do what it's got to do?
And my team works with the Volt team closely. My co-director of the Advanced Battery Coalition for Drivetrains, which is this laboratory institute we've set up, is Bob Cruz, who's the executive director of hybrids, electric vehicles, and batteries at GM. We're very serious about this. We've engaged GM engineers, U of M, academicians, and students and postdocs, everybody from undergraduate students to people who are faculty are now entrained on this problem. It's very exciting.
Cool. What do you think of the way GM is working on their battery design? They've got this prismatic cell, mm-hmm. I believe, versus, say, what Tesla's doing, where they've got a bunch of basically laptop battery cells.
Yep.
Yeah, I understand the chemistry is actually proprietary and different from what Tesla's doing, but they're trying to capitalize on the manufacturing efficiencies. Mm-hmm. GM didn't go that way. What do you think? I mean, what's the better way to go?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for reasons of addressing bigger, I mean, I'm an EV fan, right? So I would like to see a large portion of the portfolio go to electric vehicles for a lot of reasons, strategic reasons, environmental reasons. I'm a big EV fan. And so
noise both, reasons for me.
I'm sorry?
Noise.
Noise.
Quiet.
It's quiet. Yeah. It's very quiet. Of course, then you hear all the other stuff in the car,
but okay.
Yeah, that's fine. So I answer from that perspective. In terms of addressing larger sections of the portfolio, I think you need batteries that are made for cars. And whether you start off in a commodity product or whether you use that to springboard someplace else.
Hey,
there's Peter with Bob Lutz.
There you go.
That's
the Volt.
Bob.
There you go. There's a Volt. And I think ultimately you're going to wind up with batteries that are made for cars and battery cells that are made for cars. And the reason is because you have to pay to carry around your own power supply in an automotive battery, but you really don't in a laptop. So the gravimetric properties, the properties divided by mass, are just not as important because, you know, the human is carrying that. But in a car, it's the whole deal, right? So if you want to make a battery that has good gravimetric properties, you have to minimize packaging. You have to select materials with really high power and energy density. They're really fundamentally different sorts of batteries than those that you might put in a laptop, even though you might engineer systems around them to make them robust enough to put in a vehicle.
So you're arguing for prismatic.
I am.
Yeah. And just, you know, prismatic are like, if I got
flat.
This right, they're flat batteries.
Yeah.
It's like layers, so
yeah.
They stack real well.
Yeah.
Whereas what Tesla's using are round batteries.
Like
so you put
shot.
A bunch of round ones together, think about it, like a bunch of batteries. There's gaps in between them.
But it's
an inefficient packaging.
But I think to David's point, I mean, it's a commodity. So I think, you know, one of the things that underlies your question, if I may, is it's a commodity product. Right? Mm-hmm. Versus something that's more advanced, and why one strategy right. versus another. Is that right?
Well, I understand, and I've spent a lot of time with Tesla, and they're basically, their point is, look, we're going to piggyback mm-hmm. the computer industry's volume mm-hmm. and manufacturing costs so we can do this a lot more cheaply, and we've got a great way to make it work, and then we're going to design our own battery pack. On the other side, I've been told, well, it does work, but it's not an optimum battery pack for a car. And one of the reasons is you've got this, first off, it's tougher to dissipate heat.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is you've got 6,821 connectors to each one of these cells. And that's just many more chances for failure and problems. And the guys at GM who have talked about this just say, you know, look, we respect what they're doing, but
I mean, hats off, they built an EV. Okay, so first off,
sure.
That thing.
Second
off, I'm a battery guy, right? So I think that the battery is the bottleneck. I absolutely mm-hmm. think we don't have suitable batteries to address a large portion of the portfolio. I don't think, for me, the question is, can you do it with laptop batteries? Tesla's shown that you can build a vehicle. It's quite a
yeah.
fast vehicle.
Car runs, I've driven it.
Absolutely. And me too. And it's, you know, quite fun. And but if you want to address a bigger section of the market, you really need to build batteries that are large format, that have
great big surface area, so you get good power out of them. And that really suggests a prismatic format. Now, will companies stay with laptop batteries or batteries that are next generation laptop batteries? I doubt it. I mean, you know, companies like mine and bazillions of other companies like mine will be racing and making better batteries. Mm-hmm. And so those companies will adopt those batteries. That's not an issue. But I think the nice thing is that they've shown that you can make a really nice roadster with batteries. Now, as far as the GM approach, I endorse it. Of course. I mean, I voted with my feet. I work with these guys really closely. I trained a bunch of their engineers. You know, I think that everybody who's really interested in electric vehicles and would like to see them built here ought to endorse that effort. You know, I really believe it'll be successful.
Peter, of course, one of the reasons GM's doing the Volt is it's got to change its perception. And that's
absolutely
one of the topics that you hit in your column on auto extremists this week, is that GM still has this huge perception problem to overcome.
Yeah, it's gotten worse, actually. I really believe it. They've been in the soup for 8 solid months. This negative, constant bleeding in the media. I mean, we've talked about every time Brian Williams talks, the GM bug appears over his head, it's usually one of two things, bad news or bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. No focus on the products. They're building the best products they've ever built. Mm-hmm. Several very competitive products with anything out there. Yet the perception is that GM is this loser company. And they have to, I used to call it the toughest job in automotive marketing history. Now I'm just calling it the toughest job in marketing history, period, to change the image of this company.
Well, what do you make of the report that came out today that they're even talking about changing the GM logo and maybe even making it green instead of blue?
Well, first of all, the minions down at the Rennsteig need to keep their mouths shut. Because that was probably in a war room somewhere and somebody talked. And, you know, even if they are thinking that, don't leak that out.
You know, I have to say, I mean, we have all this stuff between U of M and GM, and it's blue, it's all good. So I'm kind of like...
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, come on.
Blue's good. I mean,
so what,
you change the other guys.
You know? Change the logo in California to green. Whatever. That's not the substantive stuff you should be really thinking about.
But I think what underlies that is the sense that...
Yeah, this is a new GM. No, what I would do is I wouldn't go dark on GM. You can't conceal the fact that Buick, Cadillac, GMC, and Chevrolet are General Motors vehicles. However, if I have the budget and I'm in charge of marketing, then I'm going to focus on those cars and trucks first and foremost. I'm not going to do a GM corporate ad. I don't have the money right now. I'm going to do what's my three best Chevys? What's my three best Cadillacs? What's my three best GMCs?
Why don't you even need a GM corporate ad?
Well, I mean, at some point down the road, you will be. You know, if the products get the consumer to embrace some of these products, eventually GM will rise up by default. You know, products will move it. Mm-hmm. But you're right. Yeah, you don't do a corporate ad now. You do a corporate ad down the road.
When the bankruptcy's over and they're out, maybe they have something that basically...
No, because they just tried this when it went into bankruptcy and it was a disaster.
But it was too soon.
Well, yeah, of course it was. But, you know, if they go out of bankruptcy, I would start focusing on the products.
Yeah, instantly.
I would make sure people knew about the brand.
You know, the green to me just looks contrived. It's like green. You know, it's interesting.
Well, you know what it says.
In Europe, everyone's talking blue as being the new green.
It's pandering, and it's sort of saying we're green before we have the Volt out. It's green before we have a single competitive hybrid on the road that sells in any kind of volume. None of their hybrids sell in any real volume. And they don't carry inventory for them. They don't really try to market them. I mean, it's...
Hybrids have been a disaster. Sales disaster.
Some of this is a why people go into the dealerships. I mean, the dealerships that are around now. And then, of course, those are going to be trimmed and the model's going to change. There's no doubt about that. But why do people walk into a Toyota dealership versus why they walk into a Ford dealership or a GM dealership? And really, Toyota branded their whole company with the Prius. I mean, people may have walked in may have not have bought a Prius, may have brought another Toyota product, but the point is they went into the showroom. And I think that's going to be a challenge for the American automakers to get foot traffic, to get people to look at the websites, to get people to consider the brand.
And the other challenge here is transitioning from using rebates and come-ons and 0% financing to generate your foot traffic to getting product technology.
I know, but
to get people in. I mean, it's
going to be 3,500 dealers out of the mix, and I guarantee you, you're going to generate more showroom traffic for both Chrysler and GM. I mean, it just is. A lot of all of what we're talking about is, I think, being addressed right now. That's why I raised this issue of perception. That's the big problem. I think they're fully competitive from a product standpoint right now. I really mean that, fully competitive.
I agree with
and,
you.
And, you know, you're right, Anne-Marie, that the domestics are going to have an issue dealing with what Toyota's done with the Prius. So is everyone else.
So is everybody else. That's
the
true.
Prius still, right now, today, still accounts for 50%, one out of two hybrids sold. There's about 20 or so hybrid models on the market right now. One car accounts for half of all sales. Everyone has this issue. Even Honda has the issue. In fact, the Ford Fusion hybrid damn near outsold the Insight last month.
Now, that also makes a big statement about the hybrid market, though. Well, not just gas prices, though, but it's still a statement mobile, and it's still less than 5% of the market in terms of sales.
3%.
Yeah.
3%,
I mean, look,
of which 1.5% is the Prius.
It's gotten as high as about 4.5%. So we're talking less than 5% of the market swinging with gas prices, but it's still people wanting to make a statement with a Prius that everybody knows is a hybrid, as opposed to going out and buying a Nissan Altima hybrid or something like
just,
that.
Just a highly fuel economical vehicle versus a hybrid.
Yeah, because the bang for the buck still isn't there, and if you drive an Altima hybrid or a Chevy Malibu hybrid, you know, you're not seen as that green, and you have to tell people. It's one of these purchases you have to explain. It's not readily apparent when you pull into the driveway that's what you've gone out and purchased. So Americans, I still think we're just not that hip to super fuel economy
unless it hits us in the pocket.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, we got to talk about what could be huge news tomorrow. David, is GM going to come out of bankruptcy tomorrow?
I think they're at least going to finish the 363 sale.
Which means the new GM,
right? I mean,
officially
they have to consummate it. There's a lot of procedural and administrative stuff, and they may be done with the bankruptcy tomorrow. Or at least they'll present the reorganization plan, and then judge has to pound the gavel or something. I mean, it's all sort of formalities at this point. We've known for a while what the new GM is going to look like. It's going to have about $17 billion in debt instead of about 74. It's going to be four brands. It's going to be far fewer plants, far fewer workers.
Break even at 10 million units, SAR, for the U.S. market.
And this will be really interesting because this is what Ford is saying in their turnaround plan, what they were going to break even at 10 million as well. And I've seen some forecasts, which I frankly don't believe, but I give some credibility to that we could have a 13 million market next year, which is lousy by standards going back to even 1986.
Yeah, wildly profitable at that rate.
Yeah, they would make some real money. So look, one of the things that they need, we're talking about GM now, to turn around perception is some quarterly profit reports that say they're making some money and that this wasn't. Good taxpayer dollars after bad GM dollars, and there's a light at the end of the tunnel. The taxpayers aren't going to get paid back in full on this thing. I sincerely doubt that. And Treasury is sort of
They've already said that.
Yeah.
Let's see where the stock goes.
If
they come out and all of a sudden things explode, and 3 years down the road, because it's going to take 3 to 5 years for what I'm talking about, and all of a sudden the country looks like it's getting back on its feet and roaring again, and people go, hey, let's buy automotive stock, and bow, the price goes up, the union and the government.
Basically has to get pretty close to record levels for GM in order for the government to get its payback.
Record levels of profits.
No, market cap. The total value of the company has to get... I think it's pretty close to record levels and look, here's what I worry about with profitability. Sure, the car market could come back and this restructuring has been great and the break-even point is far lower. But remember, so is pricing and margin on a lot of these vehicles because we're going to have more technology going into them to meet CAFE. We're not selling as many big SUVs. Is pricing going to be there? I don't know. Now, we also have a lot less capacity, so we're not going to have as much discounting. But, I think nobody really knows the answer to this. How good is pricing and will margins be when the big recovery turnaround comes back?
I do think in terms of the new technology going into the vehicles that you're going to see greater subsidization of that by government and for some pretty obvious pressures, right? Strategic interests, geopolitics, and so forth. And of course, President Obama has put together this very large stimulus package, and we've seen $1.2 billion hit the streets in batteries alone, and then we've got billions of other dollars going into vehicle technologies or vehicle-related technologies. So I think there's going to be some help there. But I think also to augment David's point on uncertainties, who's going to be buying cars? I mean, not only do our capital markets have to get a whole lot more stable, and not only does our economy have to grow, but all of our customers' economies in the emerging economies, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, also have to buy vehicles, and then we have to make the smaller vehicles that they'll buy. So when I look at where people are making money off of vehicles, it's not just a North America question. It's not just a U.S. question, right?
Yeah.
Well, GM's profitability is right now is from China, flat out. That's where it
is.
Well,
they have to share half of those profits. And, whenever they talk about growth in China, GM's doing well over there. Don't get me wrong. But let's temper the enthusiasm a little bit because a good chunk of their sales comes from Wuling.
Right.
Which is selling these, very tiny.
Not GM design vehicles.
Not GM design vehicles, but they're basically small work trucks. Some of them are
GM
vans.
GM has 34% of Wuling, so it's got maybe one third of.
And those aren't big margin vehicles anyway, but GM lumps them into their China sales, so it's there's a little bit of.
They're mostly commercial vehicles,
right.
Aren't they?
But I'm not just talking about where GM or any car company is particularly making money now, but who's going to be buying cars? And I guess my point would be. They're not going to buy the kinds of cars that we're making for the North American market. They're going to buy different kinds of cars. Mm-hmm. The rules are going to be different. The markets are going to be different. And they need stable finance markets as well. And so that, sitting here in North America, it's a little difficult to predict. I mean, when China sort of shrugs at writing us more debt, you kind of get a little concerned about the state not only of our finance markets, but theirs as well. So, I think there are some big questions.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to ask about if GM is going to come out of bankruptcy tomorrow. Do you think they're coming out tomorrow?
Yes.
You do? Because we've been having this contest since GM went into bankruptcy. June 1st, they went in. We created this chart. We asked different people to join in and say, how long is it going to take for GM to come out of bankruptcy? How many days? And I picked 75 days. Peter, you picked?
77.
Jason picked 120. So right now, today, we're at 40 days. So if I run up the chart here, we're way up here. So, obviously most people thought it would take a whole lot longer. We've got several folks who are mighty close. There's a Chris Bachman who picked 42 days. Also Kevin Maher, I'll say Maher, also at 42 days. There's a Steve Martucci at 44 days, Tom Hayden at 45, Gerald Thompson, 47. So we got some folks that might be able to win all the swag that we've set up on the table here. We've got.
Unless your guests take it.
Yeah, unless your guests take it, we'll slap their.
My Auto Extremist t-shirt's missing.
Oh, no, there's an Auto.
Oh, there it is.
You get an Auto Extremist t-shirt. You get an Auto Line Detroit t-shirt. You get a DVD of 10 years of that.
It's got a pin on it.
Oh, yeah, the hat with the 10-year pin. So,
Something a buddy of mine informed me that Auto Extremist is being blocked by the Chinese government.
Because of your exposé of Fuking Motors.
Yes, I believe it's because of Fuking Motors.
Yeah. No, you gave away the store there.
Yeah, they are blocking it.
Is it Chinese or is it the North Koreans who are...
I don't know, right? But...
denial of service.
Wow. That's cool.
Yeah, in Shanghai, you can't get Auto Extremist. Well, that kind of happened after 9/11. We saw the U.S. government all over the site because of the word extremist in it.
Oh.
And then is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you're kidding.
I'm not kidding. Then they finally realized, these guys are...
Yes, he is a subversive, but it's Peter DeLorenzo right now.
Yeah, he's a pain in the ass, but I don't think he's going to do anything else.
So what do you think? Does GM getting out of bankruptcy do much for the image? Or is it sort of a gavel pound and a non-story at this point.
It's a gavel pound non-story, then the work really begins.
No, I think
really
there's going to be big announcements tomorrow. In fact,
there'll be big announcement, but now the work really begins.
No, you're right.
Changing the image, changing the perception.
In fact, I wanted to alert everybody watching tonight, GM's going to host a webcast tomorrow from 4 to 4:30 with Fritz Henderson, the CEO. And you can join in. Go to fastlane.gmblogs.com. fastlane.gm.com. I'll say that again, fastlane.gmblogs.com. And or you can also go to gmreinvention.com. And this is open to the media, but also to the general public. You can join in on that. So we'll just give you that little tip because I don't think that's been really gotten out and much anywhere else. And that's from 4 to 4:30 tomorrow Eastern time.
Well, the press conference is at 9 a.m.
Yeah, press conference is at 9 a.m. And then we'll know what they're really announcing here. But I guess we know 4,000 more jobs going by the wayside, maybe one out of three of the top echelon of executives. There's about 1,300 people at the
top. All that stuff has been pretty much announced. I mean, that's the thing. That's why I say it's sort of, even some of the news coming out of this is going to be, it's stuff that's already been reported one place or another. I mean, I did a story weeks or a month ago on Henderson's whole change of the culture and management there, and he talked about a third of management going away. You know, Lutz is probably going to stay on longer than the end of this year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, he's going to stay on in some form probably longer.
Good for them.
Yeah,
and him.
It's definitely being talked about, and maybe we'll hear something about that tomorrow. Maybe not. Maybe we'll hear about that down the line. But Bob's going to stick around, I think.
I think it's pretty interesting. I mean, the level of detail that you talked about, and has been in the press, the level of detail about the changes this year. And how much detail did we hear about the banks that went belly up?
Right.
How much detail did we hear about? I mean,
Americans don't like this company. And look, I hate to say it. I'm going to get, I'm probably going to get an email from Solidarity House tomorrow, but a lot of it has to do with the UAW. Non-union Americans don't like unions, and they particularly don't like the UAW because they see it as one of the key players, and in many cases, the key player in the demise of the industry. I mean, they say management is stupid, but they say the union was greedy. And greed in this country, when things fail, is worse than stupidity. And it's part of their image problem. I've had GM marketing people tell me the same thing, that the one thing that they can't, when they really start to try to tackle the image problem after the bankruptcy, the one thing they can't address head on at all is how some Americans don't want to buy cars from you. And it's a small group, but from a union company, or they see it as part of the whole picture that they want no part of.
Okay, run rapid fire promo tape now.
Carmen, can you bring that up?
It's the Jason Vines Memorial Rapid Fire Edition.
Oh, we're not getting the audio, but okay. But this is where we take comments and questions from our viewers. And we get about a minute to respond.
And so I will end the minute quick if I think the question sucks.
Yeah.
I might just read it because it sucks. Sean P. Walsh asks, what is Anne-Marie's perception on American students being willing to go into engineering, particularly for advanced degrees?
That's a great question, Sean. They're willing to go into engineering if there's a cool problem. And vehicle electrification is about the coolest problem going, in my opinion. And so I haven't had any trouble recruiting really great students to come and join ESE or be part of ABCD or to come join the curriculum. Great problem, great students.
Excellent. Okay, Joseph Northcutt asks, considering how much it will cost to put up new signs with the green logo at all the GM facilities, couldn't that money be better spent than designing new logo? Yes. Okay, we don't need to do that.
We agree. We're with you, bro.
Phil Hopewell asks, have you guys ever thought about having a live studio audience? I'd love to come and watch, especially if we provide free booze.
Yeah. Cool? The answer then is yes.
Okay.
I don't think, given the nature of the subject matter, that we'd have a very, very friendly audience.
Yes.
It's not going to be very...
A load of crap. Okay, David, you do the fat bastard from now until the end of the show. Seriously. Okay, Michael Weber asks, if all weight is equal, why not just make the car lighter? Isn't that cheaper than a denser battery?
Well, you have to do all things. So once you sort of solve the problem of getting a battery into a vehicle and changing the propulsion system, then you still want to make that vehicle more and more and more efficient. So it's not an either or.
Matt Bocci asks, what do you guys think about the report which just came over today that Lutz is staying indefinitely now? Did you hear that?
No, I just heard it from David.
Yeah, David said.
Yeah, I had it a month ago.
I think that's great.
Yeah. What do you think of that?
You know, I, Well, it's good for GM because under Bob, their execution of the cars, design, interiors, everything got an awful lot better. I still think they need to fix the product planning part of the company over there. They're still weighed on too many.
Sadly, I couldn't step away.
I love it.
It's for you, Jason. You're the man. Ronald Wright asks, with Michigan losing so many jobs in the auto industry, can it really become a player in the alternate fuel and battery hybrid industry? What is it Michigan is doing right and wrong to get there?
Has to, right? The world wants us to.
Yeah.
So the best thing this region can do is be a clean energy solutions provider. We have this massive infrastructure. We have this, you know, army of highly trained automotive engineers. It'd be a cataclysm, just absolute tragedy, if we didn't convert this to a good purpose in profitable, marketable vehicles.
Can we do it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I believe we can too.
Yeah.
Web Companion asks, okay, have you heard the rumor that perhaps only three Chrysler plants will remain once Fiat starts making changes?
Why? I mean, you know, if I'm Sergio Marchionne and I bought this company because I say everyone who's going to be left surviving has got to have 6.5 million units of production capacity, I can't get there with only three plants. That doesn't even get me to 1 million. So I don't believe that at all.
No, he
needs every plant he's got in the Chrysler system right now.
Zoyle asks, will California hurt car companies with more restrictions and regulations, or are they on the cutting edge?
Well, yeah, look, they're not going to stop with their CO2. They just got permission in this week from the EPA to be able to enact its own CO2 standards. We've already got the head of the CARB saying, I shouldn't say that, because I can't remember exactly if it was her, I think it's Mary Nichols, who was saying, you know, 35 mpg? No, and we're talking 50, you know. They're going to kick it up another.
The only good thing is the state's so broke that maybe the CARB board will just go away because they can't.
Would be a way to save some money.
Yeah. California's lost 500,000 manufacturing jobs this decade.
Yeah.
And due to heavy taxation and overregulation of businesses. And they're just going to, you know, they're going to make it even tougher. I mean, it depends on how they're going to do, you know, these tougher greenhouse gas rules. But, you know, there's a lot of agricultural business in California. What are all these ranchers and winemakers and everybody else who need pickup trucks? You know, are they all going to be driving around in a grandfathered Isuzu?
Say to people, it's like, you know, people come to your house and put in wiring or finish your basement. What do they drive?
Yeah, I know. And I've done like 200 radio. National radio interviews since December, and you talk, and I'm all over the country, and the most enlightening one for the other end of the phone was KGO in San Francisco, and it was some big morning show there, and you know, you would expect them to be, and I started to tell, they were worried about the NUMMI plant. I said, yeah, well, you know, 5,000 suppliers supply that plant. So that's all over California and the western half of the U.S. And I said, and they started talking about, well, what about more efficient vehicles? And I said, you know, this country can't survive on Priuses alone. You know, we have needs. We need to move stuff. Just like you said, people come to your house. You know, they have to have a truck. And the guy was like, oh, yeah, we never thought of that. It's just like, what?
Yeah. Well, California's got to close the budget gap, and they also got to close the U.S. worker gap.
Yeah, they got
it. Right now,
I guarantee you, to answer the viewer's question, there will be more regulation coming out of California. You bet there will.
I mean, the people writing these regulations in California, do they basically, is there a trolley from Sausalito into downtown that they take to work every day and they never drive?
Well, I think one of the things that California, Arizona, a few other states have to work on is a path to citizenship for many of the people who work very hard in their state. I think that's a scandal. And there should be, and I don't look at it as people coming and taking jobs away from Americans. I think if somebody comes to America and works really hard, there should be a path for that person to become a citizen. And so I think they need to work on that. Now, you can rip on unions or you can rip on Michigan and auto workers and so forth, but you know what? They join the club.
Equal opportunity ripping.
It's better the way Peter said it, actually.
Randolphus Kirschevalen. Kerschevel, yeah, I think so. What are some of your favorite engines of all time? BMW M3 straight six, Ford flathead V8.
Oh,
that
my
must
God.
Be just for you.
There's a couple of great ones right there.
Yeah.
You know, the flathead. In fact, I would say, because I think one of the all-time great engines was the Offenhauser Indy race engine.
Yeah, and
which
I
was done by Miller, I believe. Isn't he the guy who
did absolutely.
That?
One of the great American geniuses. And the small block Chevrolet.
Small block Chevrolet. I always say that when we really do find that UFO in Roswell.
It's going to be powered by a small block Chevrolet.
A small block in there. And as I say, it might run on dilithium crystals, but it'll be a small block.
From Flat Rock.
Yeah. From Flat Rock, yeah.
Right. Oh, there's so many engines. Ford 302, you know, from a Ford engine. I should say the 289, more classic. The 302, I believe, was derived from that. That's one I always had a fondness for.
Classic Ferrari V12.
Right. Yeah.
Superb.
What was that first engine in the Chrysler minivan with the purple smoke? That was my favorite engine. The purple exhaust. Was it a 2.8 liter? That V6 that was really bad? That's my favorite.
The K car motor?
No, it was my parents had the first Chrysler minivan and had a really terrible engine in it. I can't remember.
Wasn't
what
that
it was.
A Mitsubishi engine?
Who knows? But my dad still yells about that engine. It was the one Chrysler he ever bought, and then he went back to. He's a GM guy.
Sounds like you kind of know how to wind your dad up. You gotta bring it up now and then.
Here's a question: What, in your opinions, are the keys for GM to successfully execute with four core brands and remaining dealers going forward? We don't have that time length of show, Fritz Henderson. I'm sitting here down the Rensen wondering what WTF, what do I do now? Okay, Jerry asks, why is it that the U.S. media jumps all over a big three big three recalls and not the imports? Well, that's a much bigger question. I don't know why.
I mean, there's been some mighty big recalls from not just the big three,
from
but
Toyota.
Toyota.
It seems like Toyota, it's a recall. It's like page six of the business section.
Is that really true? I mean, Toyota's get some very high profile recalls, and they've
but they never last. If it's a domestic recall, it's like, you know, front page and last, it seems top, you know, on the media.
I will say the national media does tend to overreport the big three recalls as compared to the recalls from the import brands that tend not to make the national news.
Well, maybe there are some lessons for American automakers in how they handle the press associated with them also. I mean, it's not just a one-way thing, right? You know, the media report stuff, but then it's handled in the press a certain way. So maybe that's important.
No, it's hometown things, you know, hometown coverage too, basically. I mean, you know, when the Seattle Mariners just go out there and lay an egg, the Detroit papers don't write about it, right? So mm-hmm. So these are our companies, so the American papers write about it.
Yeah, but it's national headlines that I'm talking about. I'm talking national network news.
I know, but these are national automakers. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. These are our American automakers, so American newspapers cover more, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, we don't cover recalls, so I don't want to take the blame.
Yeah. I will note that this week the Volkswagen Routan was recalled. Because in the owner's manual, it did not say don't place items over or near the airbag.
What a load of crap that is.
Isn't that incredible?
Come on.
I mean,
it's a
Chrysler minivan with a VW nose on it.
People have other things to do, really.
Apparently
no, they don't.
Not.
I'm still waiting for them to recall the name of that vehicle.
Yeah.
Boy, aren't they terrible at naming names?
For
the American market, their names are awful.
It sounds like a chair that Fraser Crane would own. Oh, don't spill anything on my Routan.
Right.
Hey, explain IKEA. I mean,
right.
You know.
Yeah, but Volkswagen, the Passat. I mean, it just... Anyway, next question.
Okay, Jim Haynes says, I've been a mechanic for over 30 years in all types of cars, trucks, equipment, blah, 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 and always wondered why when automotive writers like cheddar cheese...
Chubba Chubba.
Yeah, but that's right. Or speak about European cars, they are always in such glowing terms and never mention the real dark side when the warranty ends. Why don't they also talk about the reality, like the really high cost of repairs, blah, blah, blah? Well, you know, that's something I've written about. you know,
you've owned a lot of European cars.
Yeah. And the German cars in particular, they are so complicated. When someone calls me and says, oh, I found a real great deal on such and such. It's only got 45, 50,000 miles. And I said, yeah, it's a really nice car. I just caution you. All the systems on that car, all the electronics, everything in that car, once you get out of warranty, you are hosed. Like that screen in the Mercedes, they were recalling those a few years ago because they were, I don't know what happened, but it was really bad, and it was like something like $2,500 a pop.
No.
Oh, yeah, it was like $5,000 or something.
$8,000 wow. Replacement cost at the dealership.
You remember that?
At the dealership.
For that
place? To replace the nav screen.
In the Mercedes.
Wow.
Right. When you got lost and got mad and punched it and went, oh, Jesus, that cost you.
$8,000 punch. When Mercedes was their quality.
A really sweet TV for $8,000.
Oh, yeah.
just one of those. Make a U-turn as safely as possible.
Right? Yeah.
So, yeah. This
next opportunity, make it.
This technology creep in our cars, yeah, that's great. But I'm for pulling stuff out of them because I'm just, you know, down the road, unless you have a warranty. If you get a used car and you don't get some extended warranty, you're
even just, beyond that. I mean, you know, well, think about it. In 6 years' time, just to make up an example, who's going to make the chipset for the iDrive in the BMW? Mm-hmm. That is going to be seven generations out of production by that point. Mm-hmm. Lots of luck in getting
that.
The
past few years, up until I think the most recent J.D. Power survey, the biggest problems were Mercedes and BMW electronics and software issues that consumers either couldn't figure out or they were malfunctioning.
Yeah, well, remember Mercedes pulled about $1,500 worth of electronics out of its cars for that very reason, yeah. Because of
they're doing better. But
that's true. We keep pounding on the Germans. Believe me, this is true of every, you know, the Americans have the same problem, the Koreans, the Japanese, everybody does.
Well, the Germans, just because they're selling expensive cars, they've got more gadgets and electronics and luxury items in there.
Right.
It's just overkill, though.
Oh, it is. I mean, I won't get into it. I told you about my Aston Martin saga and, you know, where the car.
Give us a brief recap of that. That was good.
It had one of the key fobs. You slide into the slot and you push the button. And if the software and the whatever laser eye thing can't read the key right, the car doesn't start. So I'm backing out of parking space in a grocery store, and somebody pulls out, cuts me off, and I hit the brake before I hit the clutch, so I stall the car. You know, otherwise I hit the guy, and I try to start it up, and I'm in the middle of a lane in the grocery store, and I can't get it started again. So this woman in high heels comes over and said, "Do you want me to push?" I'm like, "No." I'm like, "You get it in steer. I'll push the car back into the spot." So, which is what I did. And then the next day, the power survey comes out, and BMW and Mercedes just got ravaged over all the electronics in their cars and in the IQS survey. So I'm like, "Oh, this is convenient." So I used my Aston Martin experience as the lead into this story about how there's just too much electronics in cars, and, you know, things like just sticking a key in an ignition slot and turning it worked wonderfully instead of pushing the key.
Technology.
Yeah. And I, you know, hey, I explain. I'm not a Luddite. I love technology. I just love it even more when it works. And and basically, I used Aston Martin as the poster car for larded up technology that doesn't work right. And apparently, this column went all the way to their board. And I won't be getting any Aston Martin car. I haven't. This was a year ago. I haven't. And, you know, they said they debated giving me another car so that I could write a review of the performance of the car. But then somebody said, well, he's going to be angry because the car didn't start, and he's going to write another nasty review, which actually isn't true. But so that's what happened.
Which reminds me of the great line in the movie Spaceballs. Jeez, even in the future, nothing works.
By the way, you know what's funny is when the woman was coming over to get in the car, she goes, it was so funny, and she was in some SUV. She goes, I'm on my cell phone, and I was just telling this friend of mine, oh my God, this dude's Aston Martin just died in the parking lot.
And that's
let's wrap it up. We're at the top of the hour and a little bit past, but Anne-Marie Sastry, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been great, and thanks for filling us in with all the latest battery stuff.
My
really
pleasure.
Cool
thanks
stuff.
For having me on the show.
David Welch, Business Week, great having you here again.
Good to be here.
I say again, even though it's the first time for me seeing you here on this show. And Peter DeLorenzo, great having you here too. And
good to be
of course,
here.
Everybody else watching and listening,
except
thank
in
you
China.
As well.
Except in China.
Yes.
They've been blocked.
Yeah.
On April Fool's, I did a column about, it was in the midst of the frenzy of, oh, GM's going to do this, Chrysler's going to do that. So I did a April Fool's column, and it was about this secretive deal by these secretive Chinese industrialists to buy General Motors. Mm-hmm. And it was... it was... I wish I had it here. It's pretty funny.
It's
but,
a pretty good column, yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, it came down to the two principals. Their last name was Fu and King, and it was Fu King Motors. And we had, Jason was the head of PR, and the way it went.
And Angus McFadden was on location.
Yeah.
Writing the story.
In Shanghai, yeah.
Writing for the Glasgow Herald, I believe.
Yeah, and the way that we did it is you got about halfway through and you didn't really know whether it was real or not. It was a lot of fun.
So also I got to mention, you can always follow us on Twitter. We're at twitter.com/outofline. Or you can follow Peter at AutoExtremist, twitter.com/AutoExtremist. And you guys have any other websites? Or
Businessweek.com.
Businessweek.com.
Labs have websites.
Sacti3.
Actually, I'm on Twitter at dwelch47.
dwelch47.
That's right. I tweet at least once every 2 weeks. It's great. I used to do it every day, and now I'm like, what's the point? Because the only people who, the people who go to follow me there, they're all trying to sell stuff.
Spam has hit Twitter. That's for damn sure.
Spam has invaded Twitter.
Yeah. I only use it to announce sites up or tonight's show, whatever.
The GM UM ABCD has a website, and my lab has a website.
Mm-hmm.
The Energy Systems Engineering Program has a website, so any smart engineers out there who want to join the fray,
sign up.
Please do. You can apply online. Yeah.
That's cool. That's really good.
So what about the gas in your Miata?
Got to take care of that now.
Oh, yeah. We got to show you the nearest gas station.
I'm out of gas.
She's on fumes.
Yeah, I'm totally on fumes. It's totally decoupled from the way I drive.
Is there not a station around here?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. But it's... You can't get there from here.
You can't if you
we'll show you how to get there.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Okay, well, cool.
Let's thanks.
Go. Call it a night.
Visit our website, outofline.detroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there and much more at AutolineDetroit.tv.
Orange, purple, silver, and blue. Change of frequency.